Dealing with diabetes. Diabetes is one of the most prevalent and poorly understood diseases, both nationwide and here in Maine. In fact, an estimated 11% of Maine's population has diabetes, a high rate compared with other states, and some 30,000 people don't even know they have the disease. Just as sobering is its financial toll. Expenses related to diabetes and pre-diabetes cost Mainers more than $1 billion every year. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today, a panel of medical experts helps us understand the different types of diabetes and what can be done to prevent or manage the disease. We'll also learn about new developments in treatment and discuss the skyrocketing price of insulin. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. There are many misconceptions about diabetes, yet it's a disease that affects nearly 30 million Americans. Our panelists today will clarify the facts about diabetes, including how you get it and what you can do to manage the disease. Joining me in the studio, Merle Westbrook. She's a nurse practitioner and clinical diabetes educator with Southern Maine Healthcare. Dr. Erwin Brodsky, he's an endocrinologist and a health services researcher with Maine Medical Center. And Dr. Michael Dedekian, pediatric endocrinologist with Maine Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you or someone you know have diabetes? Do you have questions about how to recognize or deal with the disease? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. Dr. Brodsky, I'll start with a very basic question. Can you explain what diabetes is and how it affects the body?
Diabetes is diagnosed based on a blood sugar level, and there are certain cutoff levels for diagnosing diabetes. A fasting level more than 125, for example, or an after-meal level that is 200 or more. And the reason those cutoff levels were set is because those are levels that begin to predict certain characteristic complications of diabetes over the years. Diabetes is fundamentally a problem of food and nutrient storage. We eat, but we don't burn off all of what we eat right away. We have to store it in our fat, liver, and muscle for later. And we have a hormone, insulin, that helps us do that. So if those things are not well matched, the amount of insulin you need and the amount of storage you're capable of mustering, then you get diabetes.
I see. And the numbers of those who are affected by diabetes in Maine is pretty high relative to other states. It's found in more than 11% of our population here. Why is that? Is there a reason Maine in particular has high rates?
On a population level, it tends to have to do with body weight, body mass, and weight gain. Type 2 diabetes is the more common of the two types, type 1 and type 2, and it is one that is generated by weight gain. As I said, you sort of use up your food storage capacity by gaining too much weight, more than your body can handle. And Maine has a slightly higher rate of obesity than certainly its other neighboring New England states. But there are other higher levels, for example, in the southeast United States that would be higher than Maine.
Okay. And Merle, I wanted to bring you into the conversation because you work directly with these patients. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I work in the primary care setting. My focus is diabetes management and primary care. And I focus mostly on self-management skills in the treatment of diabetes. Because I'm a nurse practitioner, I can adjust all medications. But really, my focus is getting to lifestyle issues in diabetes. I have a tendency to ask three questions when I see a patient. One is, do you feel healthy? Because they have come into the doctor many times for many years being told that their diabetes, they're not doing it well enough. They're not in good enough shape. But for them, they may feel fine. Mm-hmm. And for us to say, we would like you to do this, that, and the other thing in your treatment, and they feel fine, we need to know that. The second thing is that I ask them, do they think their diabetes is in control? We want their blood sugars to be a certain level, but they may feel fine at 200 and, in fact, be very frightened of having blood sugars that are too low. Mm-hmm. So, and then the third thing I always ask is, what can we do to help you get your diabetes in control? So it's not us telling them what to do, but in fact, they're driving the bus.
And what happens? What do they usually tell you?
They usually, I've had everything from, I didn't expect to live past 40, to I want to live to 100, and I want to be very strict about this, and you tell me everything that I need to know. But it's usually in between those two extremes.
Okay. We're going to jump a little bit back and forth because there are these two types of diabetes, and I wanted Dr. Dedekian to talk a little bit about type 1. Your patients are children, and I understand that young people more typically have type 1 diabetes. In fact, it's called juvenile diabetes. What exactly defines that?
That's right. So unlike in adults, most children we see with diabetes have type 1 diabetes, and that's sometimes called juvenile diabetes. And what that means is that the body's not making insulin the way that it should, it is supposed to. So it is a autoimmune disease where your immune system that is supposed to usually fight the bad guys sometimes accidentally fights you.
Yeah.
And if the immune system goes after the part of the pancreas that makes insulin, you develop type 1 diabetes, which we see commonly in children. And unlike adults with type 2 diabetes, in type 1, the treatment is really focused around insulin. Unfortunately, at this time, there's no pills for type 1 diabetes. It's not simply a matter of changing diet or lifestyle, but children need to go on insulin right away to prevent life-threatening complications.
And if it's happening to children, it's not from any particular behavioral lifestyle choices they're making. Is it hereditary?
That's correct. It happens, the simplest way to think of it is that it happens almost at random. It's a little more complicated than that. There's a small genetic piece, but it really strikes children really without warning, and there may be no family history. In fact, often there is no family history of type 1 diabetes when we have a child with a new diagnosis. So we don't think that it is attached to lifestyle or obesity as may be the case and as is the case with type 2 diabetes.
Then how do you recognize it?
Great question. It's something we wish all our parents knew and all primary care doctors were really familiar with. It's actually very simple. If a child is drinking and peeing a lot, and usually that's in a way that is very obvious to the adults around that child, that could be a sign of diabetes. Many parents think of those symptoms as maybe being due to a urinary tract infection or just another illness. But if there's a real increase in thirst and how much a child is peeing, that's a potential red flag, and they should see their primary care doctor to investigate.
An increase, though. I mean, this isn't
yes.
something where a baby you wouldn't be able to tell because there's no difference in what they've been doing all along.
Yeah, infants can, believe it or not, develop type 1 diabetes. It's very rare. So any change from a child's baseline is important to bring to a doctor's attention.
I read that it can be associated with colder climates. I don't know if that's a myth or, does that have anything to do with higher rates in Maine?
I'm not sure I've ever heard that necessarily colder climates. I know that there's a lot of discussion around vitamin D and vitamin D levels being lower in northern latitudes, but I don't know, Erwin, is there? Do you know anything more about that?
It's more prevalent in the temperate climates, type 1 diabetes, and the incidence and prevalence is quite low in the tropical areas by comparison. And it's one of the pieces of information that has led people to think that perhaps a virus might start off that autoimmune reaction that Dr. Dedekian was talking about, because viral transmission seems to be more likely up in the temperate cold climates and other diseases more likely in the tropical climates.
Is there research into that right now?
There is. Nobody has identified the virus, but there is that geographic pattern that you described.
Hmm. Okay, what about pre-diabetes? When we hear that, what does that mean, Merle?
Pre-diabetes is when your blood sugar is elevated more than expected, above the norm, but not high enough to say that you have diabetes. So that puts you at risk for diabetes in the future. It usually occurs if you have a primary relative with type 2 diabetes, sister, brother, mother, father. Also, you had gestational diabetes, meaning that even if you had diabetes during pregnancy and it resolved after the pregnancy, you're still at risk for diabetes in the future. Also, if you have a sedentary lifestyle, it is, I'm missing something, Dr. Brodsky. It is age 45 or above, and
okay,
obesity. So if we intervene during pre-diabetes with lifestyle, diet, exercise, then the chance of developing diabetes in the future is much less.
So again, is there any way of spotting it by any symptoms that if you have pre-diabetes?
You can still have some increased urination, increased thirst, some fatigue issues. Some women experience vaginal yeast infections, even in pre-diabetes. But it's mostly silent.
Okay.
And we just screen for pre-diabetes in the adult population every 3 years.
And you mentioned gestational diabetes, mm-hmm. and that's yet a whole other category,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to add something, Dr. Dedekian?
Well, I was just going to say pre-diabetes is a very interesting area in pediatrics, too. There's actually no standard definition of pre-diabetes in pediatrics. We use the adult definitions as best we can, but kids behave a little differently. So we get a lot of questions about pre-diabetes in children and teenagers, especially in the setting of obesity, and those have to be looked at a little differently than in adults.
Okay, so obesity would be the leading reason that you would look into it?
Yes, and oftentimes children are screened for diabetes because of obesity. You asked about symptoms. One of the very common ones we see in adults and children is a darkening of skin color, especially in areas that are flexible around the neck or elbows or armpits. Looks like dirt. Many parents or caregivers think it's just kids need an extra shower or something, but the dirt isn't washing away, and that can be a sign, actually, that insulin resistance is evolving.
Why does it cause that?
Insulin is a growth-promoting factor. It's very similar to growth hormone and causes some areas of the skin to thicken and darken.
Huh.
And so that can be a sign we see just on a physical exam that can tip our hand to screening for diabetes.
Okay, interesting. And as far as gestational diabetes, again, how does that arise when someone's pregnant?
Gestational diabetes is usually in the later part of pregnancy. Now, we have some patients who've had diabetes and then get pregnant. That's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
They have pre-existing diabetes. But gestational diabetes is really in some part caused or augmented by the pregnancy, and it comes later. And it comes with the growth of the placenta. The placenta of the fetus make certain hormones that create resistance to insulin.
Okay. So the big one that we haven't talked about yet as much is type 2 diabetes, the most common kind that people have, and it affects more adults in this case than children. Is that correct?
It does. I actually wanted to make the point, though, that adults can have type 1 diabetes, too.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be a number of people listening to the show who have type 1 diabetes as an adult. I think the oldest patient I've had who developed new type 1 diabetes was 82 years old.
Oh.
So it can happen not only in juveniles. And because they require insulin to survive, people make mistakes thinking that because they're adults, maybe we should just put them on a diet and take the insulin away. That would be a very disastrous thing. So,
So
all healthcare practitioners need to recall there are type 1 adults as well. But type 2 diabetes, there are about 100 genes or more that are associated with type 2 diabetes. And so there are type 2 diabetes patients can look like all kinds of different things. Some of them are overweight. Some of them just have a lack of capacity to develop fat for food storage, and they look thin but act obese and metabolically.
Mm.
And so they have the hallmark is what we call resistance to insulin, as Dr. Dedekian was talking about, that they've exceeded their capacity to store food. And they need lots of the hormone insulin in order to store what they eat. And if they don't have enough insulin for that purpose, their sugars start to rise in the blood. They digest the food, but it can't leave the bloodstream.
And we've talked about misconceptions. It's a misconception that it is caused by a diet high in sugar or obesity necessarily.
Right. It's not so much caused by sugar, although I have to say that high sugar-containing foods tend to lead to weight gain. That's fairly common. But yeah, it's exceeding that ability to it's overfeeding yourself, I would call it.
Mm-hmm.
It's eating more than your body can handle and not exercising enough to burn it off. And the body size of a person who's in that situation can vary quite a bit. So it'd be a mistake to just say that it's for people who are obese. That's not always the case. Sometimes thinner people can also exceed that capacity.
Okay.
But I would like to say that as you have diabetes, as the nature of the disease progresses, many people with type 2 require insulin. And they get to the point where by 12 years having the disease, that some of them even require multi-day injections of insulin, just like they have type 1 diabetes. So that's very common. It's not their fault. It's just the nature of the beast. It's harder to treat over time, diabetes is. So that's very common for that to happen.
And yet not everyone does need insulin.
Not everyone does need insulin, but the population is aging,
mm-hmm.
and they're having diabetes longer and longer as the population ages. So more common to need insulin as the disease progresses.
And you mentioned, you said it's not their fault, which is a huge element with diabetes. It's one of the few diseases where people say you did this to yourself. Is that right?
That's right. And I just dropped that right at the door. To me, it doesn't matter how they got there, but they got there. So now it's time to fix it. And the patients respond much more willing to listen to you if you don't judge them and their lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what about prevention? Are there ways to prevent type 2 diabetes?
There are. Merle was talking about that a short time ago with a diabetes prevention program. There are currently diabetes prevention programs around the country, and there are several around the state of Maine that are funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They're based off of some research that was done in the 1990s called the Diabetes Prevention Program that showed that aiming to lose 77% of your body weight and exercising regularly decreases the likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes by about 59%, 58% perhaps. And so it's really a potent, lifestyle therapy is a very potent way of preventing diabetes.
Is there any medication that people can use for that?
That same study showed that the medication metformin will reduce the risk by about 35%, which wasn't as good as the lifestyle intervention, actually. There was a third medicine that worked even a little bit better, but it had some liver side effects, so they stopped the use of that in the study.
So bottom line is it's always good to make those good lifestyle changes. Well, we just need to take a quick break right now. So when we come back, we will go to your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Freeport Wild Bird Supply, a destination for bird enthusiasts for nature gifts, feeding supplies, and guided tours. FreeportWildBirdSupply.com. And Skudik Institute, pursuing collaborative solutions to critical environmental challenges through discovery. Support their work at SkudikInstitute.org.
At a UN climate summit in Poland, the Trump administration is promoting fossil fuels, but local officials from around the U.S. are there pledging to reduce emissions.
Sort of says, hey, look, the water's warm. If Pittsburgh can do it, we all can do it.
Plus, the investigation into alleged ballot fraud in North Carolina. That's this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Travel is heading next to Italy, to Sicily. Consider joining us next May on another of our Maine Public Travel cultural explorations. You're invited to join Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz and other friends of Maine Public. Our Many Flavors of Sicily 10-day tour will involve sightseeing, tours, lectures, and music that will offer insight and understanding of Sicily and its people. Learn more about Maine Public Sicily Tour and schedule by visiting our website, mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, Understanding Diabetes. Joining me in the studio, Erwin Brodsky. He's an endocrinologist and researcher with Maine Medical Center. Michael Dedekian is a pediatric endocrinologist, also with Maine Med. And Merle Westbrook is a nurse practitioner and clinical diabetes educator with Southern Maine Healthcare. We invite you to join the conversation, although we seem to be having a little bit of trouble with our phones. So if you want to weigh in today, please send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or tweet at MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. And we were just talking a little bit more about type 2 diabetes, and I wanted to know whether there are new treatments available. What's been happening on that front?
There's been an expansion of medical pharmacologic treatments for type 2 diabetes. I won't go into the weeds with all of them, but they attack different parts of the physiologic problem. Some of them alter hormones that might decrease appetite and rate of digestion. Some of them actually cause you to pee out more glucose in your urine so that it leaves your bloodstream and you can flush it away. Those are some of the more recent innovations in recent years.
Okay. Merle, go ahead.
I would like to say that when any of your providers are deciding what treatment is appropriate for you, it's very important that they understand what your blood sugars are doing at home. My goal in my practice is, and this is very individual because the 40-year-old is going to have a different treatment plan than an 80-year-old. But generally speaking, I want a blood sugar of 90 to 130 before they eat, and then 100 to 180 2 hours after they eat. So if the medications that are on the market now, and there are 40 of them for type 2 diabetes alone, it's very important that we understand where are your elevations in your blood sugar so you can make an educated decision about what's appropriate for you.
Okay, we're going to go on the line now. We have Joan Fink. She's a diabetes patient as well as a volunteer at Southern Maine Medical Center. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
How are you?
Good. I wanted to hear your story. I understand you have type 2 diabetes. Can you tell us when you found out you had it and what happened after that?
Year ago Thanksgiving.
Oh.
And I knew it wasn't diabetes because nobody in my family had diabetes. Now, that said, my lifestyle makes me a petri dish for diabetes.
Why is that?
I'm an utter sloth. Oh. I'm heavy. I'm old. So this showed up all of a sudden for me in the form of a UTI.
Oh, I see. And then what?
And they said, you know, your sugars are in the 500s. Did you know that? I had no idea what that meant. I said, no, is that bad?
Pretty bad, huh?
We went from there. I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing. I figure I've eaten well for my whole life, and now it's time to put some structure around that. I was with the exception of that extreme time, I've been totally asymptomatic.
Wow. And so what else have you done to manage the disease?
Mostly diet and insulin.
Okay.
And when I say I'm asymptomatic, I think that's one of the things when you're somewhere in the middle, like under control, I think that's one of the things that makes it very difficult because you feel just fine. You know, I don't feel a high blood sugar. And so it makes the discipline of checking your sugars and using your medications the way you're supposed to use them kind of a challenge when you don't really notice that there's a problem to begin with.
So what's been the hardest part about having it?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I think the learning curve. I think more than anything else, the learning curve. We sort of live in a world where you have X, you find out all about X, you treat it, X goes away, and you're fine. Well, diabetes changes as you change. The things that affect your sugar one day will not affect it the next day. You have friends who can eat this. They're diabetic. You can't eat that. I have a friend who can't touch watermelon. Watermelon doesn't bother my sugars at all. Give me a grain of rice, and I go up into the stratosphere.
How so interesting.
It's different for everyone, and that makes it, you really have to find your own path. There's no template out there. You need good guidance and fair discipline, because I'd stretch if I called myself well-disciplined. I wouldn't be in this mess.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Joan, and we're wishing you the best.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, Joan Fink is a diabetes patient, and she's a volunteer at Southern Maine Medical Center. So Joan interestingly said that it changes as you change. Is that the case, even Mike, is that the case even with the patients that you see, that this is an evolving disease?
Yes, it definitely can be. I think every child who has diabetes is unique, and how food and how their lifestyle affects them is all going to be different. It's a lot. Children with diabetes have an excellent prognosis. They're very healthy. I think it was very telling that we just heard that you usually feel well even if your numbers are not perfectly in line, and that is very true. And that's she's exactly right. It does make it challenging to take care of yourself in the best way. But yeah, kids are always a moving target. They're growing, so their doses of insulin are changing. Puberty changes your response to insulin. So absolutely, kids have some unique challenges.
I'm going to read an email from Loretta. She says, diabetes is an incredibly misunderstood disease process, starting with the fact that type 1 diabetes does not occur because of lifestyle choices. Please make the distinction on your show. Disease shaming is not helpful in managing an illness that really benefits from friends and family knowing that you have it. And for that matter, no one should be shaming type 2 diabetes patients either. Is that correct?
That is correct.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. When we have children that are newly diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, they usually stay for 2 or 3 days at Barbara Bush Children's Hospital at Maine Medical Center. And we make very sure to talk to families about how this is perceived in their community and in their family. We don't want a mother or father being blamed by other relatives or them feeling guilty that it was something they did to cause this to happen to their child. So one of the first things out of my mouth when I meet a new family is that you did not cause this to happen. So I agree with that statement very much.
Okay.
And I would like to say that I never call a patient a diabetic patient. Mm. They are a patient with diabetes. And so they are a person that has a chronic disease that unfortunately there's no cure, with the exception of gastric bypass for type 2, but we won't get into that today. But they feel like they're judged all the time. They're judged at work. They're judged at home. That's very difficult to go through life like that. And you can't get past helping them if you can't get past that guilt and blame.
And there are a lot of other complications from diabetes, right? I mean, it can be fatal.
Yes.
And it can cause blindness. What other are the other sort of bad things that will happen?
Yeah, that's the part that, you know, I like to avoid talking about as much as I can is the complications, because our hope is always that we can prevent them. And actually, we're doing a whole lot better at preventing complications in recent years. The likelihood of getting complications is decreasing, which is great. But the other ones would be kidney disease. So you get scarring in the kidneys and loss of kidney function over time. And probably and neuropathy is nerves that don't function well, usually the longest nerves, the ones that go down to your feet. And then the most common one is actually cardiovascular disease, the same kind of problem that everybody who doesn't have diabetes can get in our society, or many people can. So we try to minimize risk factors, not only by controlling blood sugars, but also controlling cholesterol, controlling blood pressure, and other things that lead to those.
Okay. Go ahead, Merle.
It's interesting, because when I ask a patient who has diabetes, what scares you about diabetes? They almost always say amputation and blindness.
Oh.
But it's, in fact, heart attack and stroke that is their biggest risk in type 2.
And people don't realize that necessarily. Okay, I'm going to read another email from Carter. My son was recently diagnosed with type 1. It's been a scary and frustrating experience. We're trying to obtain a Dexcom, a continuous glucose monitor, in order to better monitor his blood sugar levels. However, it seems our biggest battle is with the insurance company. In your experience, have you had patients whose insurance companies make obtaining this technology so difficult? And what resources are available to help families like mine struggling to adapt to this new normal? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a very common struggle that families have. And I don't think it's any secret that we live in a healthcare environment that is far, far from perfect. So I would say to that family that at the Diabetes Center that we have through Maine Medical Partners and Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, we do everything we can to advocate for families and help them navigate the insurance landscape to try to get them some of these newer technologies, which are very exciting. And we don't have 100% success in getting the technology that we need for families, but we do pretty well. So it's definitely a struggle, but we're right in there with families and we're there as advocates and hopefully taking a lot of that burden away from them in terms of making phone calls and contacting insurance providers and making a strong case that this technology really is necessary and standard of care for some of these children.
Okay, Merle, you wanted to add to that.
And even in the adult population, there's been an explosion of continuous glucose monitoring like the Dexcom and the Freestyle Libre that has Medicare is now paying for the Medicare population. There are some criteria for that, but to be able to see what your blood sugar is every 5 minutes really makes a big difference in relation to treatment.
Is that what those are? I wasn't sure what you referred to those devices that,
yes,
that are new.
Yes, that's the Dexcom that that woman sent the email about. Mm-hmm. And then there are several of them that what are called CGMs that are associated with insulin pump therapies. But the new CGMs are actually geared toward multi-day injections on non-pump patients.
Right. Okay. And we have an email. Thank you for your email, Carter. We have an email from Grace. This is long, but quite compelling. Please talk about the shortage of endocrinologists in Maine. I cannot begin to express to you how discouraging and exhausting finding good care for a type 1 diabetic is, especially if you don't have an easy access to Boston or Portland for medical appointments. Our daughter has found it impossible to secure an adult endocrinologist in the Bangor area. Ideally, our daughter would have a team of healthcare professionals that can help her achieve optimal care, yet it's not possible right now with a doctor shortage. So she is piecing together care as she has moved from pediatric care to adult care. There's quite a bit more, but you can feel the frustration from Grace. So thank you, Grace, for your email. Is there a really severe shortage?
There is a severe shortage. This is actually not uncommon in rural states, but it's become more acute in Maine recently. I've been working on this quite a bit, and the Maine Medical Association is about to convene a group of stakeholders to discuss this. But the Endocrine Society, which is a group of endocrinologists, a professional group, did a workforce analysis in 2014 and said we should have at least 21 to 27 full-time endocrinologists per million adult population. Maine has a million adult population, and we have about 13 to 14 full-time equivalent endocrinologists in the state. So we're somewhere around half, and we have a lot of those people potentially retiring as well. So it's an acute problem, a real concern for all of us. And many centers around the state, to the point of the person writing, have closed recently. I thought Bangor was actually taking some patients, but I don't know of any place else in the state other than our place taking adult patients and maybe Bangor.
Wow, that is a
most
shortage.
Have closed. Central Maine Medical Center may now be taking some, but it's the appointments are very few and far between.
So a lot of frustration out there. I have an email from the offices of Senator Susan Collins. Senator Collins is the founder and co-chair of the Senate Diabetes Caucus, along with Senator Gene Shaheen from New Hampshire. Since founding Senate Diabetes Caucus 20 years ago, funding for diabetes research has increased from $319 million in 1997 to $2.02 billion in 2018. Senator Collins has learned a lot about the difficulties and heartbreak that diabetes causes for so many American families as they await a cure. She has consistently worked to increase awareness of the threats posed by diabetes, invest in research, and improve access to treatment options. And earlier this year, Senator Susan Collins chaired a hearing in Washington on the rising cost of diabetes treatment. At the hearing, an American Diabetes Association officially released a report examining the insulin supply chain and the cause of rising prices. Also at the hearing, a father from New Gloucester, Maine, discussed his concerns with affording this life-saving drug for his son. which does bring up a huge other topic that we will get to, but we'll take a quick break before that. First, a word about tomorrow's show. We're taking a listen back to our Made in Maine gift guide. Be sure to check our website or Facebook page for the full guide. And if you'd still like to add a suggestion to the list, post it to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Portland Pottery, with its 28th annual holiday show featuring more than 90 artists, opening December 14th. PortlandPottery.com.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, the U.S. Supreme Court is at a turning point. The solidification of a conservative majority with the addition of Justice Brett Kavanaugh has set up major legal showdowns over everything from immigration to privacy and the presidency itself. This week, join us as Jeffrey Rosen explains what can happen on the most hotly contested constitutional questions of our time on the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
Coming up today at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, from prisoner to crime reporter, we talk with Carrie Blakinger about her experiences in prison, including solitary on narcotics charges. And we'll talk about Texas prison reforms her reporting has led to. She covers criminal justice, specializing in prisons and the death penalty, for the Houston Chronicle. Join us.
And you can listen to Fresh Air this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Managing Diabetes. Joining us today, Michael Dedakian. He's a pediatric endocrinologist with Maine Med. Erwin Brodsky is also an endocrinologist and researcher, also with Maine Med. And Merle Westbrook. She's a nurse educator with Southern Maine Healthcare. Join our conversation. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Maine Calling Facebook page. We do seem to be having a little bit of trouble with the phone, so those other methods are probably better. We do have a call, though, that we were able to get on the line from Ellen Wells. She's Project Director of Healthy Living for Maine. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you for having me.
So tell us what it is you do there.
Well, I'm the project director for Healthy Living for Me, and we're a statewide network of chronic disease self-management and falls prevention classes. And so included in that, we have the Living Well with Diabetes program, mm-hmm. which is a diabetes self-management program, and they're free classes that are offered all over the state of Maine currently.
Well, great. Thanks for sharing that. So people are able to find more out about that by going to your website?
Absolutely. There's a lot of information about the Living Well with Diabetes program, also the National Diabetes Prevention Program. And again, these are both free programs. There's the Living Well with Diabetes is 6 weeks long. It's led by generally lay leaders who have some experience living with diabetes themselves. And it really helps people learn how to deal with their diagnosis and their symptoms of diabetes and, the fatigue and frustration and challenges that go along with it. Also, setting up action plans is a big part of the program. So they really take away some steps that will help them, again, live with their disease and, live up to their, best health and
okay, great. Well, thanks for sharing that, Ellen. Ellen Wells is the project director with Healthy Living for Me. And now we will go to an email from Cecily. She says, in discussing prevention, I'm hoping your panelists might be able to touch on community, state, or national interventions that get beyond putting the onus on the individual. What about school meals? USDA just weakened school meal nutrition standards last week. Or what about walkable communities? Any comments about that, what's being done?
That's a great comment, and I agree. I think the essence of that comment is that if we're going to fix this, it has to be a societal effort, and we want to make big changes in our society in terms of preventing disease. So I can speak to that just a little bit by saying that the 5210 Let's Go program, which I'm involved with at Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, is a statewide effort that really tries to look at every sector of society and where we can promote healthy living in children. And Dr. Tori Rogers, who leads that effort, is now working in the adult population as well on these kinds of issues, not only what's going on in schools, what's happening in our workplaces, what's happening in our cafeterias for adults and children. So I wholeheartedly agree, and we've been, I'm proud to say, national leaders in that in Maine. A lot of the resources that Dr. Rogers has developed are used nationally. So there's more to go, for sure, but I think that really hits a very important issue that we need to change as a culture and society if we're really going to make a big impact in prevention.
And I agree. I'd like to jump in and say that Dr. Tedekian and Rogers and their group need help from policymakers in this regard, because the point that was made by the person who wrote in, that we need walkable communities, is true. A lot of people think that we live in these great, beautiful, wide open spaces in Maine. What a great place to walk. But really, it can be very difficult to go for a walk in Maine. Some of the rural roads have very high speeds on them. People are afraid to walk out in remote areas by themselves. So sometimes rural places actually need more sidewalks. We wouldn't think so, but it's true.
And we don't usually make that connection all the way from walking trails to diabetes, but there is a connection.
There's undoubtedly a connection.
And diabetes is the lowest county in Maine that has diabetes is Cumberland County and York County are the two lowest incidents of diabetes in the state of Maine. When you're going north, it's much more prevalent as a general rule. And they don't have resources like there are present in southern Maine.
Right. Okay. We're going to jump over to talk about insulin. We mentioned that earlier, and that's quite the raging topic as far as the prices of insulin just going astronomically higher with no end apparently in sight. What is there a way to know why they're going up?
I certainly have followed this, but I do not know why they're going up. And I'm glad that Senator Collins and the Diabetes Caucus is looking into it. I guess I'm old enough or have done this long enough to remember in the 1990s that a vial of insulin cost in the 30-some dollars per vial range, and it's now between $350 and $420 for that same vial of insulin. So it's been extraordinary, and it takes a big toll on people. There are people who skimp on their insulin in order to be able to stay alive with it, but they lose a large amount of weight. They can become quite frail just because of the fact that they can't afford their insulin, and it can be life-threatening as well. So it's really a disaster, if you will, an economic burden on patients.
Well, when you said the price per vial, $350 or something like that, and how many vials does someone usually need to go through if they're not rationing it?
It varies. Those who are pretty sensitive to insulin and need low doses usually need at least two each month, a long-acting and a rapid-acting insulin for their meals. But those who may be a bit more resistant to insulin can use a dozen vials a month. It can be quite a lot. It varies a lot from person to person.
There are some patient assistance programs that are available. Certainly, Maine Health, patients that are part of Maine Health have what's called a program called MedAccess, where their patient assistance programs, they have coordinators. You can refer to them, and they can try to get some programs where the insulin is the cost is less, or they get the insulin for free. And it also covers during the donut hole of during their Medicare donut hole, which is really important. The second thing is that most people don't realize that you can get Novalin, NPH insulin, and regular insulin right off the shelf at Walmart for $25 a vial. I'm long of tooth also. I use that insulin all the time. It was the insulin that we had for years, and it was fine. And they don't even need a prescription in the state of Maine.
And people don't know that?
They don't know that.
Is there any difference?
It acts differently than the designer insulins that are higher cost. But in the situation where there's no insulin versus that option, it's a better option.
Mike, do you have parents coming to you with concerns about how to afford the insulin?
Yeah, it's definitely a hardship for for some of our families. It's very common for us to hear that families are meeting their deductibles, which can be very high on some plans. That being said, it's unusual for me to see a child in clinic that doesn't have access to the types of insulin that they need. The generic forms of insulin that were just mentioned can be a nice resource for adult patients. For children with type 1 diabetes, those are less helpful insulins to use. We wouldn't use those insulins in children. They really need the newer rapid-acting forms of insulin and the newer longer-acting forms of insulin. To not use those would be a real deviation in care. But children have somewhat different resources, somewhat different insurance rules around them, some different supports from state of Maine. So I'm not saying it isn't a financial hardship for many of our families. It very much can be. But our children do usually get the latest and greatest of what they need.
Okay. We have an email from Heidi, and she wants an answer to her question about diet. My question is, are there any studies about a plant-based vegan diet improving blood sugar control? My daughter has type 1, and it's in our experience that when she eats healthy plant-based foods, her blood sugars are more easily managed with less postprandial spikes.
When I meet families for the first time, I tell them that there are three medicines for diabetes: insulin, food, and exercise. And I think we emphasize those latter two less often than we should. It's true for type 2 diabetes as well. So I am absolutely a big believer that food can be a very important medicine for diabetes. It does not take the place of insulin in children with type 1, but we live in a carbohydrate-rich environment. And I explain to children and their families that carbs are food that turns to sweet sugar in your body. And kids usually don't think of it that way. So when they have pasta and rice and potato, it turns into brownies in their body. And when I explain it that way, it kind of resonates a little bit more. So absolutely, if we all ate more of a plant-based diet, and I don't think there's one diet that is the right way to go for everybody, but if we all ate less carbohydrate, more plant-based diet, Erwin and I could probably retire a little bit earlier. So.
We have a similar question from Janet as far as diet goes. I'm interested in knowing if the panel sees any benefit in type 2 diabetics taking cinnamon and turmeric, or are there any other supplements that are helpful in patients with diabetes?
There was a research paper describing the benefits of cinnamon back in 2002. I recall the article. And since then, the people who've tried to repeat those results and get the same results have had sort of equivocal findings. And so the American Diabetes Association has said, we don't really know if it's beneficial. And they sort of they haven't put out an endorsement for cinnamon and turmeric at this point. So there have been some papers that say yes and others that say no.
It's one of those things where it probably can't hurt, though, right?
Oh, I don't think it would be harmful. No.
Right.
Just if you want to hedge your bets, you can go ahead. We're just not sure.
As I said earlier, it's very important that the patients understand their blood sugar no matter what diet they're on. The things that are so popular right now are their paleo diet and the fasting diet. But really, if a patient is aware of what raises their blood sugar, it doesn't really matter what diet they're on. There are certain foods that, even if they're healthy, may raise their after-eating blood sugar value. And then, for instance, my mother has diabetes, and she can eat pasta till the cows come home. She doesn't go up, but if she has rice, she's way up. So it's very important that the patients understand their blood sugars, where they start before a meal and where they end 2 hours after, to get an idea, regardless of what type of eating plan they're on.
Does your mother listen to you for advice, given this is your area of expertise?
She's probably listening, so I'm going to say, oh, yes, always.
Great. Okay. We have a message that says, I was diagnosed with type 1 latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, LADA, when I was 50 years old, after a truly healthy lifetime. I was shocked to learn I had a chronic illness and now inject insulin 4 times a day. Since then, I keep learning of other adults in my community who have also had later onset of what is usually referred to as juvenile diabetes. What is the incidence in Maine of this type of type 1 diabetes, and what caused this in me?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the incidence exactly of adult onset type 1 diabetes is in Maine. I'm not quite certain of the statistics, but we certainly see it a lot. As I had mentioned, I have a patient age 82 that developed type 1 diabetes. So it's certainly prevalent, and there's we think that the cause is the same as it is for everybody else, which is that your immune system decided to destroy or make dormant some cells that produce insulin, and it could be a virus that induced it, which is why it seems so random. That's still uncertain, but it's a theory.
Still a lot of unknowns there.
There are.
There's another question here, an email from Cynthia. I would like to know if you and your guests would explain the difference between diabetes and reactive hypoglycemia, and how are they treated differently? What is hypoglycemia?
Well, hypoglycemia is low blood sugar, going below normal, which is would be below the level of 70. Reactive hypoglycemia is something that occurs after eating. It's fairly common in some people who've had stomach surgery, that when the food is digested too fast and induces a surge of insulin too quickly. But it occurs in people who are predisposed to type 2 diabetes also. The timing of their insulin is wrong, so that the insulin comes out late, tries too hard to catch up with the food that's being digested, and overshoots. And then the pancreas makes too much insulin, and the 2 to 5 hours after eating, the blood sugar falls too low.
Okay, we're getting a lot of questions, so I'm just going to keep going here. I think this one's for you, Mike. It's an email from Oma. My grandson was diagnosed at 20 months, now age 8. He has had constipation issues for over 6 years. All digestion and health tests come back negative. We have found insulin can cause constipation, and many others have had this problem also. Do you have any patients with this, and do you have any interesting tips or info to add beyond keeping glucose numbers in check, good diet, and being healthy?
I will have to plead ignorance on that one. I don't know that there's a strong link there. I'd look to my other colleagues here to see if they know anything about that. But certainly constipation is a common problem in pediatrics in general, and the causes can be complicated. And there are other autoimmune disorders that we would want to look at to see if we're going on. It sounds like those were tested in this child. But I don't know that I know it's related to insulin per se. But.
Are there any obvious side effects or other things that happen when you are taking insulin?
That you could have some local irritation depending on the insulin at the site of injection. You can also, I've had a couple of patients who actually have done better on their blood sugars, have responded better. If I switch to a different insulin, it's very strange. It can be the same type of insulin, but a different company. Also, the biggest side effect of insulin is hypoglycemia, is the blood sugar going too low.
Right. Very high doses of insulin can cause some sodium and fluid retention and puffiness also.
Okay, so much more to talk about, but we're out of time. So thank you all for joining us today. Merle Westbrook is a nurse practitioner and a clinical diabetes educator with Southern Maine Healthcare. Dr. Erwin Brodsky is an endocrinologist with Maine Med. And Dr. Michael Dedekian is a pediatric endocrinologist with Maine Medical Center. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Tomorrow on the show, the Maine Calling Made in Maine Gift Guide. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.